This is day one of the 2006 Idyhwyoh Bible School. Our third period teacher is Brother James Mansfield. His general topic is those who overcome. Today's topic is Leah. Brother James.
Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
For a first morning, that is superb. Normally everyone's asleep or a bit shy, so that's great. That's a great start. Brothers and sisters, we're going to look in our series together on those who overcame. We're going to look at people like Leah and Judah and David and Manasseh and Samson. We're looking at people who had a huge problem in their life. And if they didn't overcome that particular problem, it would keep them out of the kingdom of God. Our series is designed to be very, very encouraging because all of us know in our heart of hearts we also have problems. As the Lord said, there is one thing you lack. And for many of us we realise that there is one or two problems that we've got in our life and we spend time trying to overcome those problems, but sometimes in the middle of the night you wonder, is that problem enough to keep me out of the kingdom of God? Brothers and sisters, we're going to look at a whole group of people who had huge problems, and every single one of them overcame those problems. And the point is, God can help us overcome all of our problems as well. God can turn us around as well. And you might think, well, is there something that links together our series? There is. The thing that links all of our people together is our God. And we're going to come to realise just how unbelievably good our God is. The aim of our studies is so that we can be motivated, so that we can start to cooperate with God, and God can turn us around. And sometimes that is the problem that we've got with our problems, is we think we're the ones who've got to fix our problem up. That is wrong. We've got to be motivated so God can overcome our problems, and we're going to see that in the lives of all of these people. The first one is Leah. And we're going to go and try, as we go through our life, to look at five things. We're going to look, first of all, at what the problem was that she had. We're going to go a bit deeper and see, is there some wrong thinking that she had? We're going to look at what brought about the change in her life, at what point she did change, and then we're also going to look at the evidence that she had changed. And that's really all we're going to do this morning. Okay, open your Bibles in Genesis chapter 22 and at verse 16 and 17. Genesis 29, verse 16, Laban had two daughters. The name of the elder was Leah, and the name of the younger was Rachel. Leah was tender-eyed, but Rachel was beautiful and well-favoured. Now, at first it appears very, very simple what the record is saying. Okay, Genesis 29 and at verse 16, obviously it's telling us that Rachel was absolutely stunning, but Leah was very ordinary. We're going to spend a bit more time looking at what it means when it says that she was tender-eyed. But just looking at the record, it's telling us that these two girls were always compared together, and Leah was disadvantaged by that. You imagine their mother would take them in the pram to Haran's shopping centre, and there's two girls in the pram even when they are very, very little, and you could not help but be drawn to Rachel. She was beautiful. And you know that yourself in Sunday school. You see some children who are just very, very cute. You can't help but be drawn to that child. But Leah is ignored. And as teenagers, Rachel's got all the boys around her, and Leah is ignored. That's what happens with Jacob. It says specifically that Jacob was drawn to Rachel. He loved her, and Leah was ignored. You think about it. You imagine that you were in Leah's position. All through your life, you've got a stunningly beautiful sister and you are ignored. What would happen to you? You'd become bitter, you'd become envious. And you'd see it by looking into your eyes. There's this bitter envy. Why is my life like this? Why can't I be like Rachel? But I suggest that didn't happen. And that's why it's very, very important to properly understand verse 17. It says she was tender-eyed. Has anyone got any idea what that means, tender-eyed? You've probably got something in your margin. Now, I'm very old and I'm going deaf, so you're going to have to yell out. Now, that's the normal translation. A lot of translators, good translators and good commentators, suggest that her eyes were weak. Jesenius, again, who was a very good commentator, says she had weak, dull eyes. So you get the idea that this girl was bleary-eyed. She had glasses that were the size of Coke bottles. She had trouble seeing where she was going. But that's not what it means. I think the authorized version of tender or soft is correct. It's worth noting that down, I believe, in your margin. Where it's got she was tender-eyed, right next to that, she was tender or soft. And there's a couple of translations. She had tender or soft eyes, and a couple of the translations is 2 Samuel chapter 3 and at verse 39, and Proverbs 15 and at verse 1. The first one, 2 Samuel, says that David is weak and tender compared to the hardness of Joab, and Proverbs 15 and at verse 1 is a well-known quote, a soft answer turns away wrath. And it's telling us that here was a sister whose eyes or whose disposition was soft and tender. Yes, of course, she was always unfavourably compared to Rachel, but she didn't develop bitterness and envy. She was a very loving, soft, tender sister in the truth. And you might say, hang on, later on she's going to have a huge argument with her sister. But again, it wasn't bitterness or envy. She simply wanted her husband to love her. That's what all sisters would expect. All right, verse 18. Jacob loved Rachel. And Leah has no problem with that. She doesn't try to interfere, which obvious is a loving, beautiful relationship between Jacob and Rachel. We all know the story. Jacob has to work for 7 years, and finally, at the end of 7 years, in verse 21, Jacob comes to his father-in-law and says, "Give me my wife, my days are fulfilled, that I may go in unto her." And of course, then the house is filled with the excitement. All of us are going to go through that, where you're getting ready for a wedding. And Leah is very happy to cooperate with that. Verse 22, they used to know how to organise marriage feasts then. Laban gathered together, in verse 22, all the men. Only men would go, not even Leah or Rachel. And notice what it says. That was a joke, by the way. Not a very good one. But in case you're thinking, what's he talking about? Notice what it says in verse 22. It is a feast. And Strong's tells us, literally, that is a drinking. Now, we all know the story. He's going to carry out this masterpiece of deception. He's going to get Jacob to marry Leah and not Rachel. Here's the first way he can do it. He would ensure that at this feast or this drinking, Jacob is quite intoxicated. The second thing is in verse 23. It's in the evening, it's dark, and the custom tells us that the girls would be heavily veiled. And what does he do? He comes, can you picture it, from the viewpoint of Rachel and Leah. There's Rachel. She dearly loved Jacob. She'd been waiting for this day for the last 7 years. Her face is just beaming. She's excited. "Dad's going to take me to be married to the one I love." And Dad walks straight past her. He grabs Leah. Can you imagine how Leah would feel? Here is someone who is always unfavourably compared to her sister. She knows that Jacob loves Rachel and not her, and she is dragged against her will by her father to be taken to Jacob. Why? Because this callous, uncaring father simply wants another 7 years free labour. A lot of commentators suggest that perhaps Leah was part of this deception. We'll see later on she had no part in the deception at all. And heavily veiled, in verse 23, he took Leah, his daughter, and brought her to him, and he went in unto her. And it came to pass in the morning. Brothers and sisters, can you picture this? There is Jacob. He wakes up. And his very first thought, as it had been for the last 7 years, was, "My darling Rachel. I wonder what she's doing." She's not somewhere else. She's with me. She's right next to me. For 7 years, I've been waiting for the morning when I can wake up and look across at my darling. Ah! That's literally what would have happened. As he looked across lovingly at his beautiful Rachel, and behold, that's the surprise word in Scripture. It is Leah. Can you imagine that? Expecting to marry the person you love and you end up with the sister. And when I think of my wife's sister, no, I don't go there. Can you imagine how Leah would feel? She'd spend the night anxious, in tears, and hoping that she would have time in the morning to say to Jacob, "Jacob, I had nothing to do with it. My father forced me." But she doesn't have that opportunity, because verse 25 is quite clear. Behold, it was Leah, and Jacob said to Laban. There is no opportunity for Leah to say, "Look, it's not my fault." Jacob is straight out of bed. He puts his dressing gown on and he goes to Laban absolutely furious. I know it's not part of the story, but look at this Laban. He represents man at his worst, callous, uncaring, passionate about making money. Jacob is furious, and Laban is cool and calm and calculating. If I play this right, I can get another 7 years free labor. Verse 26, it's not the custom. Well, why agree to it in the first place? Verse 27, fulfill her week, and we will give thee this also. Who's he talking about here? When he's talking about her, he's talking about Leah. When he's talking about this, he's talking about Rachel. He's talking about his children as a farmer would talk about cows. "You're going to have this heifer now, and next week you're going to have that cow." That's how he is talking literally about his gorgeous daughters. And so in verse 28, Jacob, despite the fact he was furious, he did so. He agrees to spend another 7 years working for Laban so he can get the wife that he really wanted. And verse 28, he fulfilled her week. Whose week? Leah's week. Can you picture that if you were Leah? You've got to spend another 7 days with this person who doesn't love you. He loves your sister. And even worse than that, see his unrestrained joy. After 7 days, he finally takes Rachel, the wife that he really wanted. And Leah is neglected and left. Can you picture it? Can you ever imagine that? Your brother or your sister, both of you, married to a person that you love. The only thing that kept her going in the early stages was her relationship with God. And as Paul would later on suggest, she told God everything. Everything, every feeling. She told God her real feelings, her sadness, and her relationship with God was brutally honest. And you might say, is God worried about some sister, about her feelings? God was vitally interested. He was not at all impressed that this sister had to go through a very difficult situation. He knew how down she was because she told him every day in prayer. And God tried to do what he could do to fix her problem up. In the early days, he gave her the only source of comfort he could give. He gave her children. In verse 32, and Leah conceived. Brothers and sisters, before we go there, I think it's good to just stop for a second and look at the comparison between Leah and the other people in our series. You look at some of the other people like David and Manasseh and Samson. They developed huge problems in the truth because of their own wrong choices. They are the only ones to blame. Leah is in this situation not because of a wrong choice. Her situation was forced upon her. But her situation, and again we have great feeling for her, but her situation was so much worse. Why? Because she had wrong thinking. And we're going to see every single person had wrong thinking. What is Leah's wrong thinking? Here it is here. I must have equal love and attention from Jacob. And if I do not get equal love and attention, the same love and attention that my sister's getting, my life will be unbearable, I'll never be happy, and my life is hardly worth living. And brethren and sisters, when we develop the I must type thinking, it is a self-fulfilling prophecy. If we tell ourselves our life won't be any good unless we get this particular thing, it'll be unbearable, that's what will happen to us. Our life will be hardly worth living. And brothers and sisters, we are exactly the same today, because so many of our problems in life is because we've got the same I must have thinking. Sisters say, I must have a caring husband. If not, my life will be unbearable, I'll never be happy, and life is hardly worth living. Sisters, there's no such thing. Or, I must have children who, as teenagers, will not drive me mad. And if not, my life is unbearable, I'll never be happy, and life is hardly worth living. Brothers and sisters, there's no such teenagers. I must have a job without any hassles, because if I do have hassles at work, my life is unbearable, never happy, life is hardly worth living. Brothers and sisters, there's no job like that. I must have a work for myself to do in the ecclesia where no one will criticise me. And if that doesn't happen, my life is unbearable, I'll never be happy, and my life is hardly worth living. There is no job in the ecclesia where you will not be criticised for it. And if you spend your whole life thinking, no one must criticise me, your whole life will be unbearable and you'll never be happy. To me, one of the most important points that we're going to make out of this study is you need to change I must type thinking. There's no problem saying I strongly desire a caring husband or a good job or a work in the ecclesia where I won't be criticised. But brothers and sisters, if it doesn't happen, we need to accept that and make the best of our life. And that's exactly what Leah had to do. And the good news is that she did change her thinking and she did develop the right sort of thinking. She accepted the reality that she was in a difficult position and she was still able to lead a relatively happy life. Why? Because of her relationship with God. You know, we're not going to find ourselves in a situation like Leah. It's illegal to be married to the same person with your sister or brother, except in Utah. It's allowed there, though, isn't it? Yeah, okay. But, Jen, unless you're in Utah, it is allowed. Our problem may not be like some of the other people we're going to talk about, problems of murder and adultery. The thing that may keep us out of the kingdom of God is a particular relationship with our brother or sister. And it can be our wife or our husband. And you may be sitting there saying, yes, I've got to admit, I've got some big problems with a particular person or a particular group of people. But I'm right. They're wrong. Are you sure? It would be a great shame to miss out on the kingdom when you haven't committed some of those more obvious sins, but to miss out because you did not show love to your brethren. Technically, you may be right, but even a wrong attitude can keep you out of the kingdom. Okay, let's come back to verse 32. God gives her the only source of comfort. She conceives and bears a son, and she calls his name Reuben, see a son. Who's she concentrating on? She's concentrating on God. Brothers and sisters, we all know what it's like when you have your firstborn child. I remember when I drove home from hospital, I just went berserk. I mean, generally I go berserk, but I was driving all over the road. I was shouting for joy. That's what this sister and Jacob is experiencing at this time. As she says to God, see this son. As she realised that God was looking after her, doing what he could to improve her situation. She was also saying to Jacob, look at this son. Look at this son I've bought for. I've given you a son. Surely now you can show me equal love and attention. She's going to have a lot of children. Jacob is not going to change his attitude. Therefore, she has to change her attitude and her expectation. She has another child, calls his name in verse 33, Simeon, which means hearing. Again, her relationship with God is reasonably good. God has heard my difficulties. But then in verse 34, she goes too far. She conceives and bears again and says, now this time will my husband be joined unto me. I've borne him three sons, therefore I call his name Levi, or joined. This time she doesn't want equal love and attention. She wants all his love and attention. I want Rachel out of your affections altogether. Why? Because I have given you three sons. But tragically, she's going to find it makes no difference. Now, brothers and sisters, if you find yourself in an awkward situation, of course you do everything you can to resolve the situation. But sometimes the situation cannot be changed. And if you've worked for quite some time to resolve the situation, then sometimes you need to accept your situation and make the most of it. And I think she starts to do this in verse 35. She conceives again and bears a son. And she said, now will I praise Yahweh. Therefore she called his name Judah, which means praise, and left bearing. You know, she's done all she can to get equal love and attention from her husband. She's already produced three beautiful boys and it's made no difference. So what she starts to do here is accept it and concentrate on what she did have, her boys and her relationship with God. And you think, isn't that wonderful? But think about it, sisters. You've just had three children. You've got three little children running around. You've gone through the difficulty of pregnancy and now childbirth. You've got a fourth child. And you cuddle this little baby. What are you going to do? She says, this time, I'll praise God for what he has given me. I'll concentrate not on what I don't have, but I'll concentrate on what I do have, and I'll call his name praise, because this time, I'm not going to worry about rivalry and ambition. I'm going to praise my God. And you might be tempted to think, well, that's the end of the story. She leaves bearing and she's happy. But then in the very next chapter, chapter 30 and at verse 9, when she sees that she stops bearing, she's desperate to have children. I've now got to have children through my handmaid. Now why? At the end of chapter 29, she has a measure of happiness. Her relationship with God and also with Rachel is quite good. What's happened? And the answer is Rachel has provoked the fight and it starts all over again. And again, brethren and sisters, that can be our problem when we have a difficulty with a brother or sister. You may get your attitude right with God. You may have the right attitude to them. But that particular person continually provokes you. The old wounds are open and the fight is all on again. Now why? What causes this fight? The answer is in verse 8. Rachel has the second child through her handmaid and she calls his name Naphtali, which means wrestling or fight. That's very important because up until this stage, the family fight was contained within the family, but now the fight goes public. Little Naphtali goes to the candy store in Haran and this lady says, what's your name, darling? My name is Big Fight. What? Why are you called Big Fight? Oh, Mum and my auntie are having a big fight over who Dad loves the most and who's got the most children. Now, this very provocative act changes Leah's attitude and the rivalry is all on again. Up until this stage, it's been a fight over who Jacob loves the most. But now we've got another competition, who's got the most amount of children. Okay? You may be winning on who Jacob loves the most, but when it comes to kids, I will leave you for dead. I'm going to start having children through my handmaid. And that's exactly what happens. And look what she calls her child at the end of verse 11, Gad. And Gad means troop or crowd. Okay, you want to fight over who's got the most amount of children? I've got that many kids, they're a crowd or an army. How many children have you got, Rachel? Two. And they're not really yours, are they? Poor Rachel. Verse 14, the fight continues. Reuben goes out into the field and he finds some mandrakes, which according to what they used to believe would help a woman have a child. He excitedly brings him to his mother. Rachel sees what's going on and says, "Give me, I pray thee, of thy son's mandrakes." And Leah's desperate. "Does it mean nothing to you in taking away my husband? Do you want to take away my son's mandrakes as well?" And Rachel says, "I'll make a deal." She's just like her dad. "I'll make a deal, mandrakes, and you can lay with Jacob tonight." Now look, verse 16 to me, I mean, I might be reading too much into it, but to me explains what's going on in this house. Jacob came out of the field in the evening. I think he spent a lot of time out in the field till late at evening. "Love, I've got to go and check the sheep again." What, that's the fourth time tonight. If I was him, I'd spend as much time as I could out in the field. At least the sheep don't talk back. But it's serious, brothers and sisters. Verse 16. Leah went out to meet him. Isn't that sad? Here's a sister, starved, absolutely starved of affection and love. She can't wait for him to come to her. She's got to go out to him. And she says, "Thou must come in unto me. I have hired thee with my son's mandrakes," and he lay with her that night. He doesn't say, "Well, do I have anything to do with this?" He just accepts what's happening. He cannot do anything at this stage about the rivalry in the household. But look at verse 17. Remember what we said earlier. This series is emphasizing how good God is. Verse 17, "And God listened unto Leah, and she conceived and bare Jacob the fifth son." Brothers and sisters, pretty obviously, Leah has been neglecting prayer, and she's neglected prayer and her relationship with God for quite some time. God is so unbelievably good. Leah has neglected God. But when she decides to turn, he immediately reacts and she has a son. And then another son, the sixth son, in verse 19. Look at her attitude, though, in verse 20. It's still not right. First of all, she says, "God's given me a good dowry or a present." Okay, my sixth son. I've had six of them. What a wonderful present from God. So in that sense, her relationship with God is recovering, but look what she goes on to say. "Now my husband," I've had six boys, "surely now my husband will dwell with me because I've had six sons. Therefore she called his name Zebulun, or dwelling." She doesn't want equal love and attention. She wants all the love and attention, and she wants Jacob to stay with her and her alone. Why? "I have produced you six sons." You know, Leah is like us. When we have a problem, it is a deep problem, and quite often it takes a long time to deal with our problem. Fortunately, our God is so unbelievably patient. In verse 21, "Afterwards she bare a daughter and called her name Dinah." Can you believe how sad this story is, brothers and sisters? Here is a woman who has produced six sons and one daughter, and she's still basically an outsider in her own house. "What else can I do? I love this man. I want him to show me love and affection. What more does he want?" And I think Jacob was not callous. He would have tried to show her some love. Of course he loved her, but he loved Rachel more. And even in trying to show her love, I think Rachel would thwart all of his attempts. And here was a sister who craved real marriage, where two become one in every way. But it wasn't going to happen. But worse than that, we've got two sisters involved in a fight that if this fight was not resolved, it would keep both of them out of the kingdom. It's affecting Jacob, it's affecting Rachel, it's affecting the children. If we don't do something about it, all of us will miss out on the kingdom. Now remember we said that in each situation something brings about the change. And it's the same here, brethren and sisters. What happens to bring about the change? There's two important things. Chapter 30, and at verse 22, Rachel finally conceives herself, and in verse 24, she has Joseph. I think that would have taken an enormous pressure off the house. Why do I say that? Come back to verse 1. Rachel is screaming at Jacob, "Give me children or I'm going to die." Finally, she has children, and it takes the pressure off. But more than that, she has time to think. Remember, she's got wrong thinking, and the only way to develop right thinking is to have enough time to think on the right sort of things. When she's got six boys and one girl running around the household, she would barely have time to think. But now the children grow up, and as they grew up, she starts to think, well, ever I've got that wrong thinking that I must have equal love and affection from Jacob, I'll never be happy. It's something that I strongly desire. But as she got older, she realised it's not going to happen. And therefore, I need to accept my situation, to make the most of my situation, but more importantly, to concentrate on developing my relationship with God and to develop godliness in my children. While I'm fighting, my boys will never develop a relationship with God. It's doing no good to anyone. It's not Jacob's fault. It's not my fault. It's not Rachel's fault. The problem in the beginning is Laban. But we're all in this situation together. It becomes our fault if we don't react properly. And she says, I need to start to react. I need to start to develop the right sort of thinking. And I need to get my relationship with Rachel right. And I believe that happens. Come across to chapter 31 and verse 3. It's now many years later. He serves at least 20 years for Laban. Some would suggest even more than that. Some would suggest even 40 years. And finally, in chapter 31, God comes to Jacob and says, "Return unto the land of thy fathers and to thy kindred, and I will be with thee." Jacob sent and called Rachel and Leah to the field to his flock, and he said unto them, and he goes right through the history from verse 5 to 13. And in verse 14 is the point of change. That's our fourth point. At what point do they change? And we're going to see in every single one of our people that we talk about, there is a tipping point. Do you know what I mean by a tipping point? Do you have seesaws? Is that what you call them here? Right, what happens with a seesaw? You know what I'm talking about? You walk up the seesaw and you get to the middle and all of a sudden it turns and it goes the other way. This, I believe, verse 14, is the tipping point. It's worth putting a square around these words that I'm about to read. And Rachel and Leah answered together and said unto him. It appears that the fighting is over and two sisters are in a very awkward situation, but they are cooperating together. But more than that, as we're going to see from what they say later on, both of them are developing spiritually. Verse 15, are we not counted as strangers? Of course, it's talking about their father's reaction to them. But again, there's the echo of the promises. They realised that they were strangers in a foreign country and needed to go home to Israel. Verse 15, our father has sold us. And I believe they're referring to how their father treated them on the wedding night. Leah wasn't part of the deception. Our father sold us. I didn't cooperate with my father. He took us and he sold us. And at the end of the verse, he's devoured our money. You might say, hang on, what's the our money? The our money is talking about the dowry. As we know, Jacob didn't have enough money, so he had to work for 14 years for Laban. And you get the idea, that's Laban's money. It is not Laban's money. That money was supposed to be kept by Laban in case the husband died or walked out. There would be enough money to keep that woman for the rest of her life. And they know that now their father has got that money, or the value of Jacob's labour, they'll never see it again. We're talking about $300,000 their father has taken, and they know from the character of their father they'll never see it again. Look at the end of verse 16. Now then, whatsoever God hath said unto thee, do it. Can you see what's happening in Leah's life? She's letting God, through Jacob, take the lead in the house. Up until this stage, he'd been pushed around. Now, through the direction of God, Jacob is taking the lead, and his wives are allowing him to do that. She's sensitive to God.
And so they start the trip to Israel. You get the idea that everything's okay now. Everything's fine. Leah's fine. Everything's all right. It wasn't all right. This sister has still got to put up with an enormous amount. In chapter 33, Jacob is absolutely... You don't need to turn to it. You know the story. But in chapter 33 of Genesis, Jacob is absolutely terrified as Esau is heading towards him with 400 warriors. What does he do? He gets Rachel and Joseph in the middle and protected by Leah and her children. And we think, isn't that cute? Can you imagine that? I'm going to be protection, and my darling children are going to be protection for my sister and Joseph. And then they come into the land. In chapter 34, she's got to see Dinah, who is raped. Then she's got to see the fury of her husband to Simeon and Levi, her children. She's got to see the fury of Jacob to Reuben, who dishonors his father by going in unto her concubine. But there is nothing mentioned of Leah. She doesn't intervene and say, that's not fair. It's not the boy's fault. You showed all this love to Leah and her children. It's not my children's fault. No, no, no. She accepts it. Why? What would allow a sister to be able to accept such provocation? It's because she has this depth of character, this resilience, this ability to come back from adversity. Why? Because she has an unbelievably strong relationship with God. And again, brothers and sisters, that's going to come out all through our series. If you want to overcome your problems, you need to let God do that. And the way you do that is to develop a close relationship with Him. In chapter 36, no need to turn to it, but we've got the agonizing death of Rachel in childbirth. Leah would have been there, absolutely distraught as she sees her sister's life ebb away. Both her and Jacob would have a time of mourning. But after that time, the death of Rachel brings no benefit to Leah whatsoever. The love that Jacob used to have for Rachel is not poured out now upon Leah, but it's focused on Rachel's sons, Joseph and Benjamin. And we think, well, isn't that cute? You know, he loved Joseph and Benjamin so much. Can you imagine how hard that would have been for Leah to witness that? Knowing that it's going to cause so many problems within the family, as it does later on. And finally, as an old woman, a wonderful sister in the truth died. And Jacob realizes, my wife is dead. You know what? It shows what unusual creatures husbands are. After his wife is dead, did he finally realize what he had in his wife? And the love that he did have for her. But it happened after she died. It's too late now. And I think Jacob would have been absolutely beside himself. What a remarkable woman. Why didn't I say that to her? Why didn't I just tell her once, Leah, I love you? But it doesn't happen. And she's now dead. Come across to Genesis 49 and at verse 29. It's many, many years later. He is now a very old man. He gets the boys together, the sons of Leah and the sons of Rachel, and he charges them and he says, there's a very, very important point. It's the issue of where I want to be buried.
please bury me on the way to Bethlehem next to Rachel? No. I am to be gathered unto my people. Bury me with my fathers. I want you to understand that I want to be buried in the cave of Machpelah. Why? That's where my fathers are buried, and I want to identify myself with them and what they stood for and what they believed. Verse 31, but there is another reason why I want to be buried in that cave. There they buried, before I read it, it's worth putting a square around his wife and his wife. I'll explain why. Verse 31, in the cave of Machpelah, there they have buried Abraham and Sarah, his wife. You might say, hang on, Sarah wasn't his only wife. There was also Keturah. The issue is, there they have buried Sarah, his true wife. And there they have buried Isaac and Rebekah, his true wife. And there I have buried Leah. And what should be next to Leah? My true wife. You know, Jacob carried this cold, lifeless body of Leah into this tomb. And he places her very carefully. He wants to make sure everyone understands there is a place next to her, and that's where I want to be. He placed her next to him because at the end of his life, when it's too late to tell her, he realizes that's where she should be as my true wife. Very much in the mould and the spirituality of my grandma Sarah and my mum Rebecca. You know, Leah is unaware of the final token of love and honour that her husband showed her until the resurrection. And she will come out of a long sleep of death. It will be just like us, waken out of a deep sleep. She'll look around, where am I? I'm in the cave of Machpelah. And the very first thing she'll do, she is lying down, she awakens, and she turns over and looks across at her right-hand side, and she says, behold, it's Jacob.